This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Speaker Series. My name is Cheryl Peach. I'm a program scientist here at UC San Diego's Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. It's a great pleasure to have you all here this evening. We're very lucky to have, as a speaker this evening, one of our very own graduate students, Josephine Stiller. She's a PhD candidate here at Scripps in the Marine Biology Program. And when I was talking to Josephine to get a little bit about her history, she said one thing that you all should know, and that will resonate with all of you, is that she's always loved animals and nature, and biology has always been her passion. And I think she's living out that passion in the work that she's pursued. We're very fortunate that she has come here. She came serendipitously as an exchange student from Berlin, from the Humboldt University in Berlin. And she ended up working with Greg Rouse as her thesis advisor. Well, the outcome of their work together was, in fact, an outstanding thesis prize from the Berlin Society of Friends of Natural Science given to Josephine for her excellent work. So when funding came available at Scripps for work on sea dragon population genetics, rather than run a protracted search for which, Greg has said, we would have received hundreds, if not more, applications for that graduate position, they knew that they in their lab that they had their best fit in Josephine. And she's proved them right in innumerable ways since then, not the least of which was her tenacious efforts to get the tissue sample and doing the genetic sequencing that would ultimately lead to the discovery of a brand new species of sea dragon, the ruby sea dragon. And so we're extremely fortunate to have Josephine here speaking to us about her groundbreaking work about which she is so passionate. Please join me in welcoming Josephine for her talk titled Unleash the Dragons, Secrets of Sea Dragon Biology. Josephine, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Cheryl, for your kind words, and it is really a pleasure and an honor to speak here today, and I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight to learn about these fantastic fishes that I get the opportunity to study. We have been seeing these videos playing for quite a while now, and it shows you how we sample sea dragons for our work, but what the videos also show you, how intricately sea dragons are adapted to their environment, how beautifully they merge in with their habitat. And they're just such an amazing thing that evolution has brought to us. As Cheryl mentioned, I love all things living, no matter if squishy or fishy. But the sea dragons have a very special place in my heart. And a lot of people seem to share that fascination, like I do. And sea dragons are hugely popular in Australia with divers, and they're also very popular in aquaria. At our very own Birch Aquarium, we have sea dragons on display, and they educate us about marine life, about evolution, and they also help raise awareness for protecting our marine life and protecting life in all of its variety. Surprisingly, sea dragons have received very little scientific attention. There are only a handful of papers, and there are many, many secrets to their biology and to their secretive lives. So the title of my talk, as mentioned, is Secrets of Sea Dragon Biology. And I would like to introduce you to the sea dragons by addressing four common questions we often get from the general public about some of their biology. But the main part will focus on our work here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and in Australia. The Sea Dragon Project has started over a decade ago with my motivated advisors, Dr. Greg Rouse, who is a professor here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and Scripps alumnus Narada Wilson, who is a researcher now at the Western Australian Museum. Over 10 years ago, they started working on these fantastic fishes, and I want to share with you what we've learned since then. The last part of the talk will be the introduction of our new species, the ruby sea dragon. This was really a huge surprise to us. We did not expect this. And I want to share the story of the discovery with you. And I also want to share with you how we want to study this enigmatic species in the very near future. But let's start with four secrets of sea dragon biology. Looking at a sea dragon, it may not be entirely obvious to you what they really are. They look so odd that it's really hard for us to really distinguish what kind of an animal they are and if there are, in fact, animals. You may think that it's a weird hybrid between a seahorse and a seaweed. As an evolutionary biologist, I like to answer the question of what a sea dragon is in relation to its evolutionary heritage. So where do sea dragons fall in the tree of life? Both from morphology and DNA sequence analysis, we know that sea dragons are in fact spiny rayed fishes, and they are a tiny twig of a group called the Cynathidae. Cynathid means fused jaw, and it accounts for the fact that all members of Cynathidae have these elongate snouts with some fused bones in them. They use those to accurately and effectively suck in their prey. They're really killing machines, even though they look very cute. They feed on all of these tiny particles you can see here in the water. They are so-called sea lice or mysa shrimps. And this is what our sea dragons really like to munch on. The cynathids are relatively diverse with approximately 300 species, and they have some really famous members like the seahorses and different pipefish lineages. While it is quite odd that there are 50 or so species of seahorses, there are only 3 species of sea dragons. And as I mentioned, the third one was only recently discovered, and for the majority of the talk, we will only speak about the 2 better known species of sea dragon, which have been known since the early 1800s. There is the leafy sea dragon, Phycodurus equus, with its brilliant orange coloration and the very elaborate appendages in green and brown. And then there's the common or weedy sea dragon, which has simpler appendages, but really stands out with its amazing colors and the polka dots on its side. Another really intriguing factor about sea dragons is that you have to travel pretty far to see them or have an amazing aquarium like Birch Aquarium in order to see them. Sea dragons are only found along the southern coast of Australia, and here they really prefer the shallow waters. We can find them up to depths of 30 meters, so approximately 100 feet. In orange, you see the distribution of the leafy sea dragon, and it can be found in the states of Western Australia and South Australia. There are some lighter shaded areas in Victoria, and those are records where leafy sea dragons have historically been recorded, but in more recent years, let's say the past decade or so, we haven't had any records of leafy sea dragons in this area. Doesn't mean that they are not there anymore, it's just they haven't been recorded. There's also this area, which is a little bit hard for us to study because it's basically 1,000 kilometers of desert and really steep cliff faces, and there's basically no human settlements, and it's very hard to study if sea dragons are even present in that area. So this is just one example of how little we know about sea dragons. We don't even know the full distribution. The common sea dragon, shown in blue, has a much wider distribution, and we generally understand the biology a tiny bit better than the leafy sea dragon. As the name suggests, the common sea dragon is a little bit more common, and you can find it in all of the major cities of Australia. It occurs from Perth in Western Australia to Adelaide in South Australia, Melbourne in Victoria, and then to a little bit north of Sydney in New South Wales. And we can also find common sea dragons in Tasmania. I want to show a few examples of the habitat that sea dragons live among, mostly because they are so adapted to their habitat, so they are really members, they really interact with their environment. Australia is, of course, very well known for the fantastic Great Barrier Reef, which is off the coast of Queensland. But we will never find a sea dragon among coral reefs. they tend to prefer the more southern areas where the waters are colder. Sea dragons really like visually complex three-dimensional habitats, for example, kelp forests, as in Tasmania, and we often find them among seaweed. They will also inhabit rocky reefs, which are covered with sponges and overgrown with different seaweeds. So they like to hide among structures, and their whole bodies are adapted to do so. The common sea dragon and also the leafy sea dragon will often be associated with piers in major cities. So they will hide among the pier pilings, and some of the videos you have seen before were shot under pier pilings. Sadly, both seagrass habitat and kelp forests are known to decline across the range of sea dragons, and this is one of the main factors that we are a little concerned about, that sea dragons may be slowly losing the habitat. Mostly due to their popularity, sea dragons are protected both at the state and the federal level. But a lot of people just assume from this that sea dragons are endangered. But the scientific evidence we have for this is actually quite limited. We just don't have the data to say if they are endangered or not. This is also reflected in the listing of the IUCN Red List that lists both sea dragon species as near threatened. What this category means is that threats have been identified for sea dragons, most prominently the habitat fragmentation that they may be experiencing, but we currently don't have any data on population trends to really make a statement about their health in the wild. The next big secret of sea dragon biology is, why do they look so funny? Why do they have these appendages? You are a very bright audience. You have already figured it out. They have them for camouflaging. But I want to get a little bit more into detail and really challenge your sea dragon spotting ability. A lot of people assume that the appendages are fins, but they are not. They're not involved in locomotion, and sea dragons cannot really move their appendages in a proper way. They, like other fishes, sea dragons have a set of fins behind the head and also on top of the tail. The fins are just really hard to see for us because they're very transparent and they flicker so fast that our eyes can't really distinguish them. The appendages are basically enlarged spines with dermal outgrowth, so they have some skin flaps sitting on top of spines. All sea dragons are encased in bony plates that cover their bodies, and each of these bony plates will have a little spine on them, and then certain spines will just become very large and have this skin appendage. You may think from these photos, those fish are not camouflaged, they stand out so well, I can easily see it here. The images are a little deceiving because we took them with flashes, so the colors really stand out. Similarly, here at the aquarium, we have artificial lighting that make the colors really pop and make the sea dragons stand out from their habitat. Under natural lighting, this is what the conditions look like. Here you have a leafy sea dragon, and you can see the colors are just much more drab, and this is especially true the deeper you go in the water column, the more of the spectrum of the light that gets filtered out, and also if the water is very murky. So now we are going to play Spot the Sea Dragon, and you can test how good of a sea dragon scientist you would be in the wild. There is a common sea dragon hidden in this photo, and you can talk to your neighbor in case you spotted it. I will give you a moment to... Yes, I see some pointing. For those of you who have not found it yet, it's a common sea dragon. Its little snout is here, the head. This is the body, and the tail, it extends down here. Fabulous. This one is one of my favorite photos, and I will explain in a minute why that is. You may have spotted the sea dragon, which is a particularly sneaky one because it's hiding behind another fish, so this is not quite fair. But I've shown this photo several times, and I've looked at it hundreds of times. And only in preparation of this talk, when I wanted to crop the photo, did I realize that there is another sea dragon in the photo, which I've never seen before. Has anyone seen it? Top right, very good. You're much better than I am. Here's another fantastic example. There's a leafy sea dragon. And here it is. You can just see how spectacular the shape of the appendages mimics the shape of the seaweed that is growing around them. But it's not only the shape of the appendages, it's also the color patterns on the appendages. Here on this leafy sea dragon, you can see these dark spots on the green background, and that seems to just mimic the shadows and the play of light we see on seaweed. And then finally, they also behave like seaweed. Here we're approaching a leafy sea dragon. It will be in the center. And I just want you to watch its movement. It is swaying in the surge, similar to the seaweed. And it's just fantastic how that evolved. Why camouflage? One reason is probably that sea dragons are ambush predators. They like to sneak up on their prey, and not being visible to their prey makes them probably get in the vicinity of the prey and then just shoot out with their snouts. Also, you have seen it's pretty effective. It works on scientists, so it probably works on sharks and on seals to not get eaten. And what the appendages also do is that they make the fish bigger than it actually is. So it excludes a certain size spectrum of predators from nibbling on them. And also, often we will see poor sea dragons that don't have any appendages anymore. Maybe this one got tumbled up in a storm, that seems to happen, so maybe the appendages just broke off. But it may also be that something took a bite on it. So maybe the appendages are similar to a lizard's tail, so they could be somewhat of a distraction. You rather lose a bit of your appendage, which is just a bit of skin, than losing your head. So the last secret of sea dragon biology, and here clearly, this is a statue in Bulgaria, which I think is just fantastic, describing how sea dragons reproduce. We actually know way, way less than this. We don't know how the egg transfer happens. Reproduction in cnathids and in sea dragons is probably one of the most exciting chapters of their biology. Because in cnathids, the male broods. He takes care of the babies. You have probably heard of male pregnancy in seahorses. The term is a little deceiving, but I can see how it originated, because they have these fully enclosed brood pouches, and they will have the babies sitting in these brood pouches until they hatch out. And they can get really bulgy and pretty wobbly, so they are somewhat reminiscent of a pregnant mammal. But seahorses are kind of the oddballs in the cnathidae. Most other members of this group will display their eggs more openly on their tails. There can be flaps around the eggs that are just on the sides of the fish, or as in many other pipefishes and including our sea dragons, the eggs are just carried on the underside of the tail. Here you see that most of the eggs of the leafy sea dragon have hatched out, and there are also these little tissue pockets where the eggs used to be inserted. But much of the biology of the reproduction of sea dragons is still not understood. No one has ever observed an egg transfer from a male to a female. We often see males carrying these bright pink eggs, but we don't really know how they end up on the tail. Sea dragons have relatively low reproductive output if you compare this to other fishes that just spawn into the water column and can have thousands, if not millions, of reproductive outcome. I'm going to show some really heartbreakingly cute baby sea dragons now, so brace yourself. Here's a newly hatched common sea dragon. This photo was taken here at Birch Aquarium, and then a slightly older juvenile taken in the wild. We think that it takes a little bit over a year for these sea dragons to get sexually mature. And with this, I would like to transition to our own sea dragon work. We mostly use molecular methods, so genetics, to understand sea dragon biology. And I would really like to take you on the journey that this project has been. It was initiated in 2005 by Greg Rouse and Nerida Wilson and many, many helping hands over the years. Both being Australians, they grew up diving with sea dragons, and they were surprised to find that there has never been a genetic assessment of either species, and there has never been an assessment of the species covering the entire range. So they had the vision of sampling populations of both sea dragon species throughout as much of the range as possible. And this is quite an endeavor. Australia is a big, big continent, and they have wide ranges. We decided to use genetic methods to tease out as much information as possible for each sample. And in the recent years, we had some major technological advances that really made us leap forward on this respect. And this is what I want to talk to you about next. But let's start with our sampling. Greg and Nerida tirelessly traveled to all of these beaches shown here and with these little dots. The common sea dragon sampling localities are shown in blue, and the leafy sea dragon localities are shown in orange. You can see that the numbers we have for leafy sea dragons are much smaller. And again, this is due to the fact that leafy sea dragons are just really hard to find, and they seem to be generally less abundant, and we just don't know that much about their distribution. This is really spectacular sampling, and I just have to express my deepest respect for this endeavor, because it requires talking to a lot of people, and it also requires being very resistant to failure and, you know, going into the water and being very cold and not ending up with any samples. There was a little bit of a gap between 2008 and 2012, and this is when I joined the team for my PhD work with the generous support only made possible through the Lowe Family Foundation. And we added in another sample site when I joined in the very southern tip of the common sea dragons distribution. At each of these sites, we sampled between 10 to 15 individuals, and this gives us a good idea of the local genetic diversity and more of an average. So I want to show some impressions from the field. This is me and Nerida in Tasmania 2012, all geared up, and you can tell that I'm super excited to get into the water and find my first common sea dragons. Also notice the thick, thick wetsuits. Tasmania was very cold. Sampling sea dragons is a pretty big logistic effort. You often have to go to remote places, and here you see Greg and Nerida and their helping hands getting all ready and entering the water. I want you to notice the little mascot, a little leafy sea dragon, all helping out and supervising that everything is in order. Usually when you come out of the water, your hands and feet are so cold that you can't feel them anymore. And so in this photo, Nerida and her colleague are standing in buckets of hot water and sipping hot tea. And again, our little leafy sea dragon is helping out. They're very cold, but look how happy they are. They just dived with sea dragons. So I want to show another video of the sampling of leafy sea dragons and just explain a little more how we do it. So here you see Greg on the right side, and he's taking a little snip of the appendage of the sea dragon. This is everything we need for our DNA work. He loses it and then captures it. Whew. Very, very elegant. So this is everything we need, and this is the least invasive method we can think about of taking samples without harming the animals. This is all, everything was approved by animal ethics, and we know that the fishes seem to be doing fine after this procedure. What we also do is document each individual. We'll have a little photo shoot, and this allows us to take measurements in the lab of regional morphological differences. So here we take the photos, and off you go. The sea dragon faces Greg and says goodbye. And this is it. So So for all of our individuals, we have a photograph and we have some idea of morphological variability, and then we have a tiny snip of tissue. But we did not stop there. We also contacted museums all over Australia trying to find more tissue samples that were housed in museums. Those were mainly beach-washed individuals. So sea dragons will often wash up on beaches and then dry up and look like this. And with a little bit of lab magic, we can even get DNA out of these samples. And we also have many trawled individuals. And you can really see that it nicely pads out our sampling of sea dragons, and the numbers bump up quite a bit through the help of museums, especially for the leafy sea dragon. The second ingredient to our project was to develop new techniques to get the most out of our samples. We started with traditional sequencing in the very early phases of the project, and we've learned a lot from this. Traditional sequencing works in the way that you sequence one region at a time. You have one reaction in the lab for one gene or genetic region. So-called next-generation sequencing, the new technology that just appeared a few years ago, you can sequence hundreds, if not millions, of regions at a time. So it's really scaling up. You may have heard about the possibility of having your own genome sequenced for just $1,000. So there were some really big advances in the medical world that brought us this next-generation sequencing. And now, slowly, us molecular ecologists and evolutionary biologists get a cut of this new technology, and we can make use of all of the information we can gather here. I would like to compare some of our older data sets to the new data sets. For one project, I investigated seven genetic regions or loci in all of our leafy sea dragon samples. Another project sequenced 1,800 base pairs, so individual letters of DNA, and we have those for all of our samples, and we've learned a great deal about it. But given the new data, we now get over 1,000 genetic regions for each of our samples, and the width of these colored bars just compares the difference, the magnitude differences we have in terms of data. For each of our samples, we get 1.8 million letters of DNA pieces for each sea dragon sample. To illustrate this, I have to move on to a next slide. This is our old data, and this is our new data. So we're really scaling up. And what also happens is that the life of a molecular ecologist changes a little. While before, we were mainly constrained by the amount of data we could generate in the lab, just the amount of pipetting you can do in a day. But now we can just generate so much data in much less time and comparatively little monetary efforts, that much of the bottleneck is actually now the processing and analysis of the data. The time I spend in the lab pipetting is relatively little compared to the time I spend in front of the computer, wrangling our data, learning how to program and to make use of all of this data. It's a fantastic, fantastic time to be a scientist in training and learning all of these transformative techniques. But you can tell that I'm really excited about it, but do we really need that much data? The answer is yes, because our genomes are very complex and they hold many, many different levels of divergence. For example, my genome holds the information that links us up to chimps. We are primates, and this information is written in our genomes, and we can access it by comparing genomes. At the same time, I have half of my DNA from my mother and half of my DNA from my father. So they're really quite different timescales of one generation to millions of years of evolution. So genetic divergence is nested and everything is written in the genome. Sea dragons are this tiny twig on the tree of life, like you and me are. If we zoom in really, really vastly, we find this, the synnathids, and then within synnathids, we have our sea dragon species. Species are again composed of smaller units, which we call populations, so geographical units. And populations are made up of individuals, and individuals like you and your mother are related through family relationships. We can access information about all of these levels using the same data because it's all encoded in the genome. Back in the old days with traditional sequencing, we had a different data set to investigate relationships among individuals and then very different data sets to look at evolutionary questions. Our projects have generated some interesting results on many of these levels, and I would like to share some of those with you now. The first example we're going to look at is comparing the genetic diversity among leafy sea dragons across their range. What we find in leafy sea dragons is that the populations we sampled in Western Australia have about a third of the genetic diversity than the other populations in South Australia. We care about genetic diversity because it tells us something about the health of the population and maybe also the ability to adapt to changing climatic conditions or to new diseases. So this could be a little concerning. As I mentioned, we are not entirely, we only have one sample population here and a few individuals that were washed up on beaches from a little further west. So to really make a statement and maybe raise the red flags, we want to corroborate these results. And so we plan on sampling at least two additional populations east and west of the ones we already have in order to corroborate this. And if the genetic diversity proves to be low in this area, this would have some implications how Western Australia may manage their sea dragon populations. Now we're moving to the common sea dragons. They have this fantastic range all over Australia. And here I color-coded all of the sampling localities with slightly different shades of coloration. And I will show you a plot now where each individual is represented by a line. And the closer the lines are together, the more genetically similar they are. The farther they are from each other, the more genetically distinct they are. And what I want you to notice here is that we have these bushes of the same color. So individuals from the same beach represented by the same color will be genetically very similar to each other when compared to the next beach. So for example, our samples from Hobart in Tasmania are slightly different from the samples just slightly north, and we can really distinguish that. What this tells us is that sea dragons probably don't travel a lot along the coast. We already knew that they don't swim that well, and there were some indications that the sea dragons may stay close to where they are born, but this has never been shown effectively, and this is the genetic proof that they seem to be migrating relatively little. Another very interesting thing we see from just this plot is that there is a huge unconnected branch, so there's quite a gap separating a group over here and a group over here. And all of these populations are on the east side of Australia. And if we look at the break, it corresponds to the Bass Strait. The Bass Strait is a seaway that separates mainland Australia from Tasmania. And so we see that there is a genetic break between these populations here from all of the populations over here. Why is that? What caused that? The answer may lie in the historical geography of Australia. Australia, like all other continents, has changed rapidly throughout the glacial cycles. During the last glacial maximum, so approximately 18,000 years ago, the poles were much bigger and were holding much more water, so sea levels were generally much lower than they are currently. So now I want to go backwards in time, and we're moving towards the last glacial maximum, so we're slowly dropping the sea level. If we go 25 meters below the current level, we see that there is a land bridge. This is called the Bassian Isthmus, and it connected Australia to Tasmania. If we drop the sea level further, it gets bigger and then entirely becomes connected. So there was a land bridge. There was no connection. The connection we have nowadays is a new phenomenon, and it only happened in the past 10,000 years or so. So if we assume that sea dragons were already present on this part of the coast, they were not communicating over the Bass Strait with these other localities. You may think, why don't they just go around here? Maybe they did, but at least in current days, we don't really have any records of sea dragons on this part of the coast or at the very southern tip of Tasmania. And you have to know that Antarctica is down here and that there is a very cold waterfront. So it may actually be a little bit too cold for our sea dragons to go along the southern tip of Tasmania. So we think that the Bassian Isthmus explains this big break we see here. And it is really, it gives you a sense of how dynamic populations are and that the situations we see nowadays are really not reflective of what happened in the past. Also, if you look at all of these other populations, they were dry land just a few thousand years ago. All of our sea dragon populations must have lived farther offshore, what is now offshore, and then moved inland once the sea levels rose. Why does this matter? It matters because this has left an imprint on the genetic diversity of all of the populations of sea dragons we have on the eastern part of Australia. All of them have much lower genetic diversity than any of the populations we see in the western part. So if we ever had to spring into action and protect sea dragons, this may be part of the coast that we want to focus our efforts on. And especially, there have been some documented changes in sea dragon populations around Sydney. We know that they are going through fluctuations there. And this part of the coast is also one of the parts of Australia that are warming the fastest. So to sum up this part of the talk, what I really think is the strength of our data set is that for the first time, we have a baseline. We know now what the genetic diversity was like 10 years ago, and from now on, we can start monitoring sea dragon populations throughout their range. We also plan on sampling some sea dragon populations that we sampled 10 years ago and sample them again this year. And this way, we can really look at genetic diversity. Has it changed over the past 10 years? Hopefully it didn't, but this is the only way how we can really effectively monitor sea dragons. And now we're moving to the final part of our talk, which is the introduction of the ruby sea dragon, a new species of sea dragon. And you may call it Australia's best-kept secret because this sea dragon was actually collected almost 100 years ago and set in a museum without anyone noticing. But the story starts with a weird tissue sample. I've told you a lot about our work and how we do our sampling and that we're usually just dealing with tiny tissue samples and not so much the real fishes. And I got one sample which was designated as a common sea dragon from the Western Australian Museum. I did my usual thing in the lab and sequenced the sample. And it showed up to be really weird. It was supposed to be a common sea dragon, but it was 7% divergent from a common sea dragon. This may not sound like a lot, but if we compare the leafy sea dragon and the common sea dragon to each other, and they are clearly distinct species, they are 12% divergent. So the 7% divergence really gave us a first indicator that we may be dealing with a new species. But at this point, we didn't have any idea, and it took me a long time to confirm and redo all the lab work and to be really sure that this was a real thing before I went into Greg's office and we started discussing this possibility. So we really needed some information about this tissue sample. So we contacted the museum in Western Australia, and they were like, oh, yeah, we have this photo that was taken when the specimen was caught. It was caught during a biodiversity survey, and they just snapped a photo of it on deck. And this is the photo they sent us, a bright red sea dragon. I still remember the night when I got this photo. I was at a friend's place, and I had to leave immediately. And I didn't sleep all night, and it was a really fantastic night. Because it's a red sea dragon. Let me remind you, the other two species are never as red. They are orange, but they're not this color. The specimen was trawled in 2007 in the very remote areas of Western Australia, and the researchers found the specimen in the net, snapped this photo, froze it, and accessioned it at the Western Australian Museum until we asked for it and we got a little piece of the tail. What you may see here is that the appendages are not there. They're either broken off or they don't exist in this species. So those are the enlarged spines, and we don't know if they carry appendages or not. Another thing to notice is that the poor thing was a pregnant male, so he carries a bunch of red eggs on the underside of his tail. So this was really an indicator that we may be dealing with a new thing, and the more we looked, the more differences we found. It was not just the coloration, there are also multiple differences in the skeleton. Here you see an X-ray of the leafy sea dragon, the common sea dragon, and the new ruby sea dragon. And of course, the leafy sea dragon is just very, very distinct from the other two, but the ruby sea dragon is as well. There is this bulgy area behind the head that is really, really big, and we don't really see that in the other two species. If you look at this enlarged spine that originates from the dermal plates, from the bony plates, we see that it's facing forward in the ruby sea dragon. In the other two species, it's backwards. And those are bones, they're rigid, they cannot move those. We always see this. And there was also an additional trunk segment that was only present in the ruby sea dragon. We looked even closer and did a three-dimensional X-ray scan. This is a micro-CT scan that we did here at UCSD. So this scan consisted of 5,500 individual X-ray slices, which we then put together using a computer, and it allowed us to get all of this information about the skeleton of the ruby sea dragon. And it is really a fantastic data set, and we were able to trace out individual bones and learned a lot about the skeleton. We named our new species, we gave it the scientific name Phylopteryx deweysii, and it is named in honor of our sea dragon enthusiast and long-term supporter, Dewey White. And we also placed the common sea dragon in the Tree of Life, and we found that it is the sister species to the common sea dragon. So they are most closely related to each other, despite that they are genetically very distinct. And then their cousin is the leafy sea dragon. And I really want to emphasize how crucial museum collections were for this discovery. All of our specimens that we had access to at this point were housed at museums. There was the holotype, so the original catch, and it came from this remote area in Western Australia from a depth of 51 meters. This is slightly deeper than the depths we usually find sea dragons at. And we think that the red coloration could be an adaptation to that, because red is one of the colors that disappears first when you move down in the water column. So this fish may be black at depth. We found two additional specimens also housed in a different museum, and they came from an even greater depth of 72 meters. A fourth individual discovered by Nerida at her Western Australian Museum was collected in August 1919, so almost 100 years ago. But yeah, the reason we did not discover those before is that they lose the coloration once they are preserved or they are dried, so it's not as obvious as on this photograph. But now that we know what we're looking for the bulgy area behind the head, the forward-facing spines, the additional trunk segment, those are all ruby sea dragons. So what happened since the discovery? We published our study in February of last year, and the public really welcomed our ruby sea dragon. For me, it was a great honor. I grew up reading this German science magazine passionately in high school and also throughout undergrad, and they had a little piece about the ruby sea dragon. It was just one of the best days in my life. And just a few weeks ago, Newsweek had a list of the 21 coolest species discoveries, and the ruby sea dragon was on them. And what is really great is how the public helps us to understand more about the ruby sea dragon. A few weeks after the publication, I come into the lab and I have this email alert stating that a rare ruby sea dragon washes up on Western Australian cliffs. A family went on a beach walk, and between the rocks, they found this bright red fish, and they remembered a story that they saw in the local newspapers. And to our luck, they took this fantastic photograph of a ruby sea dragon. So this is probably the freshest example that we have. It's just spectacular. Again, the appendages not there or maybe broken off, but aside from that, just a beautiful specimen. Unfortunately, they left it on the beach. But the photo is just amazing. The public also informed us of two other stranded ruby sea dragons, and all of these red dots tell you of localities that we know now where the ruby sea dragon has been spotted, and this is really great for us. The ruby sea dragon is still around, people still find it, but no one has seen one alive, and we really need to change that. We don't know anything about the biology, we've never seen it alive, we don't even know if it has appendages. So we want to change that. In April of this year, we are going for the hunt for red dragon. So we're going to this remote area in Western Australia. This is the area where the sea dragon was caught in 2007, and we have GPS coordinates for this one, and this is why we're going back there. We're going to Esperance, and we're taking a boat out. And we know that the ruby sea dragon was caught between these two spots. And since it's a little bit lit below the scuba depth that we're usually comfortable at, we will take a little ROV that is about this size, which will allow us to take high-definition video and really fantastic images, because we are pretty much looking for the needle in the haystack. It may not be a successful expedition. We are probably looking for a blackfish in a very complex habitat. So stay tuned about the developments. Hopefully we have good news in April. And with this, I want to close. And I think the ruby sea dragon is just such a wonderful story of the discoveries that are still waiting out there. And just a little tissue sample can change so much and can open so many new questions to address. And I want to close with a few words of thank you. I hope I made it clear that this is a huge team effort, and I'm very honored that I got the chance to speak for our team here today. I want to thank the Rouse Lab and, of course, our funding. The Lowe Family Foundation and Dewey White has been supporting all of my work, and I wouldn't be here without that support. The Carol and Stuart Smith Fellowship supports me going to Western Australia in April, and National Geographic has funded the initial years of the sea dragon exploration. And I want to thank you for your attention. I'm very, very glad that you made it out tonight, and I'm happy to take any questions. The question was about the food and if we find it in the Southern Ocean.
With the ocean at that temperature, the habitat, same habitat.
So sea dragons like to feed on mysids. They are little
the only thing that they eat then?
They So the juveniles tend to eat smaller crustaceans, so they will scale up. If they get bigger and their snouts get bigger, they will eat bigger food. And then the second question was on the predators. That is a little tricky to say. I have read that they have been found in the stomachs of sharks. We see seals playing with them, but I'm not sure if the seals are actually eating them. And some big fishes also feed on them.
But you haven't found this food that they eat in any other Southern Ocean at temperature?
No, the mysids are our group that we find in many cold waters. You can find them out here, just different species. But the general group is cosmopolitan. But no sea dragons. Sea dragons...
So it's strictly the habitat that they...
Yes, it is probably because Australia... So the question is, if the ruby sea dragon, it may not have these appendages, so it may live below the seaweed distribution. We know that in these areas of Western Australia, it's very remote and the water is very clear, and the seaweeds can actually go down to 70 meters in this area. So we think that the seaweeds are still around there. So the question is if we can distinguish sexes. So in the common sea dragons, we can. The females will have much wider bodies when they are sexually mature. In the leafy sea dragons, I think some people claim that they can. I cannot distinguish the sexes unless the male carries the eggs. In the ruby sea dragon, we have no idea. We just know that one individual was a male because he was carrying eggs, but that is a great question. The question was how long sea dragons live. Again, this is a question that we don't fully understand. We know that in captivity, they can live up to 10 years. So that has been the longest record. In the wild, where it has been studied, you know, it's hard to study them over multiple years. Some estimates were about 6 to 7 years. So the question is if sea dragons have a social life. And yes, they do to a certain degree. We often see them pairing up, especially in the breeding season. We see that males and females will pair up, they will swim together, and they will court each other. And we don't really know if they are monogamous. They are definitely not monogamous over multiple breeding seasons, so we see that from our genetic data. We sometimes see juveniles in groups, so they will form groups. But there's really not that much known on their social life. So the question is if we ever tag them to trace them. So we personally have not. There has been one study where leafy sea dragons were tagged ultrasonically. So we got some idea about their home ranges and how much they really travel. And they generally don't. They just sit. And then have little bursts of energy where they swim a few meters. I think that study was a little off-putting in the sense that it was not that exciting. So the question is, how likely is it that there are more species of sea dragons? I have thought about that. When we started the project, we never thought that there would be another species of sea dragon. And I would say it's probably not very likely, but what do I know? I did not see this one coming. It could be, there are, even though it's Australia and it's a really developed country, there are still some uncharted areas. We, you know, there's that middle region where we don't have any data. Who knows what lives at depth there?
You just did such a phenomenally good job on this talk. Thank you all for coming. I know you enjoyed it as much as I did.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.